We appreciate the presence of each one on this good Lord's Day morning. Before I get into my lesson, I was just thinking a while ago, I'd thought about it before, but it's also good to mention it in connection with what we just did and the lesson that we had in our Bible class period this morning when we were talking about the altar of incense and from the idea of the propitiation in 1 John 2, verse 2. We connected the propitiation of the mercy seat. And we went to Exodus 25 and we thought about that incense. And the Lord said that sweet incense was to be offered. Sweet incense. That smell was going to permeate the tabernacle. And every time that the high priest went into the holy place on that year, he took blood. But it wasn't, the place wasn't going to smell like blood. Now, have you ever thought about that in connection with the Lord's Supper? We just drank fruit of the vine. Tasted good. It was to remind us of blood. It didn't taste like blood. The Lord wouldn't do that to us. The high priest had to take blood in there and sprinkle it. Seven times. But the atmosphere was not going to smell like blood. It will smell like sweet incense. And every time we think about the precious death of Christ, you know, and all of its agony, all of that, still, we think about the pain and we're supposed to conjure those thoughts up and remember it and all of that, and we partake, and yet there's something so very pleasing and pleasant and reassuring and wonderful and sweet that the Lord wants us to get via the taste. Amazing. Amazing. Now, today in our lessons in the worship hour, we're going to be thinking about someone is on the throne. That's the title of these lessons. There is someone on the throne. Genesis 41 and verse 40, you might well recall that after Joseph had arisen in the favor of Pharaoh, after he had told him what was going to happen, you know, the 7 years of plenty and then the 7 years of famine. And Pharaoh says, we need to put somebody over this business of gathering all these goods. And who else is like Joseph? The Spirit of God's in the man. And so when he's talking to Joseph about it, he says, I want you over my household. Wise choice. I want you over all that I have. I want you in the government of my people. I want you over my family. I want you over my country. And he says, only in the throne will I be greater than you. My, my. I wonder what Joseph thought as he tried to take all that in. I'm going to be over his family and over his country, and he reserves the throne unto himself. Colossians 1 and verse 16, we have a New Testament reference, of course, in a context of discussion where Christ's preeminence is being given. And notice what he says, beginning in verse 13, who delivered us out of the power of darkness, translated us into the kingdom of the Son of His love, in whom we have our redemption, the forgiveness of our sins, who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. Now watch it. For in Him were all things created, in the heavens and upon the earth, things visible, things invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things have been created through Him and unto Him. When you think of a throne, what do you think of? It goes back to a word. It means to place or set. When somebody is placed on a throne, the word thronus itself has to do with, you know, that seat or that chair. It comes to mean, of course, dominion or of where some potentate sits. Other descriptions we have of it, you know, and Solomon had a throne. We're always, we think about some elevated, I guess if you're like me, you think about maybe an elevated, large, maybe humongous chair that indicates great dignity and power and authority, where somebody rules, somebody's in control, somebody's in charge. And there are many, many passages in the Scriptures where we're introduced to this. There's another word that's used in Matthew chapter 23. You might think about it in comparison with chief seats. Jesus once said, you know, that the Pharisees, they love the chief places and they love the chief seats. You might think about a throne, but it's a different word. The prominent seats, the first seats, the seats of honor. They're not asking to sit on king's thrones, but they wanted the highest places where they would be venerated, exalted, elevated in the thinking of men. We've got to get beyond the thinking of the Pharisees in order to live successfully on this earth. Always looking for the chief seat, the chief praise, the most prominence. Got to get beyond it. Got to grow up. So these seats are not like thrones, but when you think about throne, you do think about power and dominion and authority, those kinds of things. Now, go with me this morning to several passages in the Scriptures, and let's try to get the feel of the context where these words are being used. Everything, as we said this morning in our Bible class, everything that's written is written on purpose. There are no accidental references or citations in Scriptures. Go to Psalm chapter 11. Let's begin here and think about this one. Psalm 11 in verse 4. It's a very short psalm. Let's just read it. "In the Lord put I my trust." I'm glad that's still on our coins. "In God we trust." There's no telling how soon it'll be removed. "How say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain?" It looks to me like in the context of the remark he's saying, why does somebody say to me, you need to run away, you need to fly away like a bird? He says, I don't need to fly away like a bird. I put my trust in God. Somebody says to me, flee as a bird to your mountain, for lo, the wicked bend their bow, they make ready their arrow upon the string, that they may shoot in darkness at the upright in heart. Somebody says, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? We sometimes have had similar thoughts. What in the world can you do to stop something? Sometimes you can't except pray. That's all you can do, but that's a mighty thing because you're connected to the one that controls the throne. Now watch it. The Lord is in His temple, the psalmist says. I don't need to flee. I don't need to run away. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, His eyelids. Another one of these anthropomorphic expressions. His eyelids try the children of men. The Lord trieth the righteous, but the wicked and him that loveth violence his soul hates. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares, fire and brimstone, and an horrible tempest. This shall be the portion of their cup. For the righteous Lord loveth righteousness. His countenance doth behold the upright. Amazing. Do you want the Lord to love you a lot? Now, He loves all of us. Do you want Him to love you a lot? We'll like the things He likes. Share in the things that He most appreciates. He loves righteousness. Doesn't matter if you're an American or Filipino, rich or poor, male or female, bond or free. He loves righteousness. If that's the characteristic of your spirit, then you see you have the favor of God. He's ruling from His throne. And there are times in life when it looks like, you know, man, things are out of control. It looks like that to me here. Though the government still exists. And we still have, you know, civility. And we have order, for which we are grateful. I don't want mob scenes. I don't want anarchy. But sometimes you wonder about your experience and your time on the earth and what God is doing and what He's going to do and what He has in mind and how the prayers of the saints are at this moment fitting into His overall plan. You don't need to worry and flee like a bird to the mountain. Trust in the Lord. After all, He still sits on the throne. His throne. And He's always evaluating and trying the spirits of men. And He favors the righteous. And He hates the wickedness of the wicked. And you just make sure that regardless of your historical context, And where you have to live, you this moment have His favor. That's the way it's going to be. You know, righteous people have to die. Sometimes we misread some of these passages and we think, now if I'm just a righteous person, if I do exactly what God says all the time, then I'm going to have a long life, and I'm going to have a lot of money, and I'm going to have a lot of good health, and my mind is going to be sharp, and when I'm 130, I'll pass away. Now, I've overstated the case, but we do sometimes tie into some of those images. I always pray for this church and for those that are not with us. And not only do I do that, but I pray for our families. And one thing I say, keep us safe. Please keep our family members and our loved ones safe. And yet I know, just as at other places, you know, our family members finally have to die. Sometimes our children die. And sometimes that occurs and somebody starts giving up his faith. You don't have any right or reason to give up your faith over the death of anybody. After all, it was the death of Christ that brought you your faith. You can't give up faith because of somebody's death. Now, while we would like to live quite a while and have good days, as Peter suggests, still we know I may run out of money, may run out of health, and I may die. And it's possible I could die in some sort of a situation that seems so absurd in a way. You know, David one time reflected upon the death of Abner, just like dying like a fool. It wasn't anything he did. It was because of somebody with whom he was associated. But it was a reflection upon how the man died. It wasn't in battle, like a warrior's death, and all dignity and honor and courage. There are various ways to die. And sometimes when we reflect upon the death of our contemporaries, what was that about, Lord? And there's nowhere to go to find the explanation. Michael Hildreth told me a week or two ago that one of the preachers in the Philippines had been murdered. How do you adjust that to all that you know about the providence of God? How do you fit it in? Sometimes you don't have a lot of ways of fitting it in except to say, the will of the Lord be done. We know of Brother Avalo, who's had a stroke and who's paralyzed. He's under therapy and doing better, and that kind of thing happens too. And we know what happened to Bob Berard in Cambodia as he got somewhat competent in learning the language over there and just preached his first sermon, I understand it, in their language, and then he dies. And I'm saying, when you read passages like this, you have to remember that we live by permission. And James 4, we die. In Hebrews 9:27, we die by appointment. Now, if somebody says, well, all that means is it is appointed unto man once to die, and after this cometh judgment, it's appointed that you die, but it's not appointed when you die. Well, if it's appointed that you die, and if you live only by permission, as James says you do, you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall both live. There's a sense in which you have to finally somewhere come down on the point that when you die is by appointment. Now, there are a lot of factors involved in contributing to that being the time. But I'm saying God knows when it is best for me to go. Accident? Maybe. That was Bob Berard's departure. Murder? Filipino preacher recently. Might have had nothing to do with the kingdom, last Michael said about it. Police didn't know what happened, what it was about. Maybe just some evil man. Members of the church have lost their lives. Years and years ago, when I was holding a meeting in Thayer, Missouri, or somewhere up in Missouri, I learned of a woman, member of the church, who had befriended a woman in great need, and the woman killed her. We can't just look at situations and say, only the wicked die violently. Only the wicked die prematurely. Can't say that. But I can say this, and at the end of Romans chapter 8, Paul gives me something to tie my thoughts on when he says, you know, really, brethren, God has given us everything, including life and including death. How is it going to be my advantage to live as Christ, Philippians 1, to die as gain? So when I think about it like that, you know, if somebody shoots me down today, you know, my family may cry a little while, but that's all right. Get to go on and see the redeemed, see the Lord. So you think about it like that. He has given us all things, including life and including death. It's not my enemy. It's the enemy of those unprepared. But I think about the Lord on His throne, monitoring the righteous, monitoring the wicked. It is appointed unto man once to die. You live by permission. Sometimes He steps in and stops something. Sometimes He doesn't. If the time is right, according to His wisdom, He wants me to stay, I'll stay. If He wants me to go, I'll go. And when you conclude your prayers with, "In all things let the will of the Lord be done," that includes your dying as well as your living. There is someone on the throne, and all of us should seek His approval. The second case I would like to cite is Psalm 45. If you'll turn over there with me. Psalm 45, particularly verse 6. Notice here, the psalmist says, "Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of Thy kingdom is a scepter, a right scepter," the King James says. The American Standard says, "a scepter of equity." Now, this passage is quoted by the Hebrews writer in chapter 1, verses 8 and 9 in your New Testament. In the midst of his discussion of the King of Israel, verses 1 through 5, and he's discussing this king, and he's got this sword on, you know, and this king is so wonderful, and he's fairer than the children of men, verse 2. And God has blessed him. And he says, "Put on your sword." And verse 4, "In thy majesty ride prosperously because of truth and meekness and righteousness. And thy right hand shall teach thee terrible things." And he has his way with his enemies. Verse 5, and in the light of that discussion of the king of God's people, Israel, he then gives us a characteristic of God's continuing throne. And he picks up the image that applies to Jesus. "Thy throne is forever and ever. The scepter is the scepter of righteousness." And the Hebrews writer says that's Jesus. Amazing. Incredible. So let the throne here indicate to us dependability and endurance. We must live through the changing affairs of life. Things change around us all the time. We change. Sometimes adjusting to your own change is hard. Start losing your health or losing your mind or whatever it might be. You have to adjust to changes all the time. The throne of God is dependable. It goes on and on and on. It's stable. What would you do without the throne of God? What would you do without the gospel? Without Christ and the church? Where would you be today? Look at all the vacillation in the lives of people that you know, because they're not rooted. They're not grounded in concepts that are lasting and powerful and that endure and that resist you know, the destruction of a person. How do you get through that? How do you live through that? How do you take it in stride? How do you get beyond it? How do you get better because of it? Now that's a remarkable thing, that I can improve because of a situation that I didn't want in the first place, but it's to my good in the second. And you remember Romans 8:28, that all things work together for good to them that love the Lord, to those that are called according to His purpose, and that includes life and that includes death. And that includes the various things that we have to undergo in this life. Now if you go to Psalm 93, I want to use Psalm 93 in connection with this Psalm too. But in Psalm 93, look at this short psalm. The Lord reigneth, He is clothed with majesty. The Lord is clothed with strength, wherewith He hath girded Himself. The world also is established, and it cannot be moved. Watch it. Thy throne is established of old. Thou art from everlasting. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their waves. The Lord on high is mightier than the noise of many waters, yea, than the mighty waves of the sea. Thy testimonies are very sure. Holiness becometh Thine house, O Lord, forever. And here he pictures the Lord in His majesty. He has a throne and He has glory that suits His house. Do you live in a house that suits you? Saw a $1 million house one time. I don't see many of them. I don't travel around in that circle very often. But there's a very wealthy member of the church down near Foley, Alabama. Very fine, wonderful woman. And her husband, who's not a Christian, made an enormous amount of money. I mean an enormous amount. And she had a $1 million house. Does your house suit you? Does it fit you? I remember Brother Hardiman's biography. His daughter wrote about an occasion where Brother Hardiman, who was a very prominent man in his day, he was a wonderful gospel preacher. He was an educator. He was a debater. He could have gone into politics. He knew a lot of influential people. And at a dinner that honored him for his 90th birthday, about 1959, there were government people there, including Lyndon B. Johnson, who later became president. He had a lot of connections. But what I was saying was, his wife wanted some furniture one day. And he wasn't wanting to spend the money on what she was wanting. And she began to say, "Oh, you know it," I'm paraphrasing, "but you know it's going to be bad after we're gone and somebody comes into the house and sees all this. And they'll say, 'Well, I would have thought that Sister Hardiman would have had better things.'" And his daughter said, "She got the furniture."
Thanks, man.
"I would have thought, you know." Well, I'm simply saying, does your setting fit? God is on the throne. His glory becometh Thine house, O Lord, forever. And then if you'll turn to Isaiah, go over to the book of Isaiah. Chapter 66, if you will. If you can find chapter 66, if you can find the book. If you're like me, you sometimes have trouble finding everything. But in chapter 66 and verse 1, now notice this. "Thus saith the Lord, the heaven is My throne, the earth is My footstool. Where is the house that ye build unto Me? Where is the place of My rest? For all those things hath Mine hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Lord. But to this man will I look, even to him." Here's what I want, he says. You know, I'm not so much concerned about, you know, the temple. Everything you use in making the temple and having the temple, I made those things. You're bringing Me things that I made. But what do I want from you people? Well, at the end of verse 2, "To him that is poor and of a contrite spirit and trembleth at my word. That's what I'm after, he says. Verse 3, he indicates that there are some people trying to worship me, and their worship is just, it's just awful. Worshiping their lambs is just like, you know, offering dogs or killing dogs or whatever. They've chosen their own ways. Back in chapter 55, verses 8 and 9, he says, you people were supposed to make my ways your ways. But you didn't do that. So it's a sad thing here. But this is the encompassing nature of the throne of God. God's throne is encompassing. Now, you see, it's not just that you think about God in the heavens, you think about the heavens under God. The heaven is my throne. And the earth is my footstool. And you remember on one occasion in the Sermon on the Mountain when the Lord was talking about swearing in Matthew chapter 5, verses 34 and 35, He once said, "Swear not by the heaven. It's the throne of God, neither by the earth. It is His footstool." Imagine the majesty, the grandeur, the loftiness, the structure of the thing. God sits on the heavens. His feet rest on the earth. Talk about a large and looming image. Encompassing. He's everywhere. It's really a picture, isn't it, of His omnipresence. You know, there's a scene in the book of Revelation later where John sees an angel. He shows up wearing a cloud and he's got a rainbow on his head. A rainbow. Remember sitting out in the tabernacle on some of those days after a rain, and you look up and there's this large arc, you know. Maybe sometimes a double rainbow. Beautiful. Beautiful. And this angel shows up with a rainbow over his head, like a hat. And he's wearing a cloud, and he puts one foot on the earth and the other foot in the sea. And he's carrying a book. But it's the picture, again, of a large and looming image. And you're pretty small. When you think about all God is, and everywhere He's at, and everything He knows, and all He does, and here you are, don't let your ignorance drive you into fits. Don't question God. Don't criticize God. Don't turn on God just because, well, I don't like the way my life's going. I don't like the way your life's going. I don't like you. You have the reassurance in the Scriptures of a God who encompasses. And what He has His mind on and what He's looking for and what He favors is that poor and contrite spirit. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Jesus had said before we got to the swearing part, about the swearing not by heaven or earth, blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And what did Isaiah said? He says, to him that is poor and of a contrite spirit and trembleth at my word, that's the man I'm looking for. It's still that way. So though the world is still, you know, confused because of its adulation of power and kings and armies and, you know, everything that just looks so dramatic and like that. And God says, I'm looking for a person who's like me. Not that you can be everywhere like I am, and not that, but you can sit on a throne exactly like I can, but you can have a heart like mine is. It's not as big a heart, but it is that kind of heart. And that's what the New Testament is trying to get us to be. Having hearts like God. One more point here, and I'm going to stop. But I want to get to this point and conclude the lesson with it. And it has to do with the book of Daniel, chapter 7. You know, there's a lot in some of these prophecies in the Old Testament that people are always going to be wondering about and trying to figure out the time frame for a lot of things, and a lot of people are going to be curious about a lot of things for a long time. But in Daniel chapter 7, verses 1 through 14, Belshazzar, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, in his days, Daniel has a dream. Now, he already had a dream, or he interpreted a dream of Nebuchadnezzar back in chapter 2. But here, Daniel has a dream and visions of his head upon his bed, captives in Babylon. And so he's a captive, he's a righteous man, he's a good man, he's a eunuch, just like his three friends were, placed in government positions. And he has this image of these four beasts. You have them there, verses 3 and following. Now, think about this. Let's think about chapter 2 just for a moment. In Nebuchadnezzar's dream, you remember he sees this big image. And then this stone cut out of the mountain comes and destroys this image. And he interprets it to Nebuchadnezzar that he's the image. But then he discusses the various parts of it, and it comes out to be the Babylonians, the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks and the Romans. In the days of those kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. Verse 42, Daniel 2, talking about the church. Turned out to be in the days of the Romans. So it discusses the Babylonians, Medes and the Persians, the Greeks and the Romans. That's from the dream in chapter 2. Now when you get to chapter 7, again you've got four parts. You've got a lion, verse 4. You've got a bear, verse 5. You've got a leopard, verse 6. And the fourth beast, it seems, defies category. One writer said, you know, it's so strange or peculiar, it defies category. He never tells exactly what it looks like. But he's dreadful and terrible and strong and so on and diverse. And he has 10 horns. Then you come to chapter 8. Now look at this one. I don't know all the facts of the details of all the things, but just think about it like this. Chapter 2, you've got four parts. Chapter 7, you've got four parts. And then in chapter 8, he has this vision of a ram and a goat. And the goat kills the ram. And in verse 20, we're told that the ram represents Media and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece. And from that, we then have four kingdoms that come. Verse 8 and verse 22, four kingdoms. So, there's our four again. Now, Gabriel gives him in chapter 9 an explanation of it. And in chapter 9, verses 1 and 2, we see that Daniel, by what Jeremiah has said, realizes that the captivity is just about run its 70-year course. Just about over. And he prays and confesses the sins of all of Israel. He just pours his heart out to God because they came into captivity because of their heinous sins against God. And Daniel confesses those. Gabriel comes, he shows up to explain the vision. And among other things we learn in verses 24 through 27, that from the time that Cyrus decrees that you Jews can go home, it's going to be 70 weeks until something else happens. And by the time all the details are given, as I say, verses 24 through 27, the destruction of Jerusalem will happen. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city. What's going to happen within that time? To finish the transgression and to make an end of sins and to make reconciliation. We talked about that in Bible class this morning. Conciliation, appeasement, propitiation. To make reconciliation for iniquity. And to bring in everlasting righteousness. That's what we have right now in the kingdom. and to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the Most Holy. So from the time that Cyrus will say, you Jews can go home if you want to, 70 weeks going to happen, and you can get your commentaries and they'll tell you what they think that means regarding the time and the times and the halftime and all of that. But Jerusalem's going to be destroyed. But it's not going to be destroyed until certain things have occurred. I just brought all that up in the light of Daniel 7, at least to think about the point in Daniel 7 that God was going to give a kingdom. I haven't mentioned this, but notice in verse 13, the Ancient of Days, Daniel 7:13, I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him before the throne. And in 1 through 14, in all of that, notice verse 14, I didn't read that, and there was given him dominion and glory. What did the Ancient of Days give to the Son of Man? He gave him a kingdom. He gave him a kingdom. Chapter 2, verse 44, the God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom. It shall never be destroyed. The Ancient of Days, God gives to the one like the Son of Man a kingdom. You remember, you have Matthew 25, you've got the parable of the talents. But Luke will give me something that Matthew doesn't give me, the parable of the pounds. And in the parable of the pounds, Luke 19, verses 11 through 27, he illustrates the point that he's trying to make in the parable by this man, this nobleman, who goes away, leaves certain people in charge, just like the talent, the man in the parable of the talents does. But in Luke's account of the parable of the pounds, the man who is leaving, the nobleman, is leaving to receive a kingdom. Matthew didn't tell me that about the man in Matthew 25, in the talent parable. But in the pound parable, Luke says this nobleman, he takes a journey, he goes away. Well, why is he leaving? He's going to receive a kingdom. Man alive, how applicable. Jesus left the earth. He receives a kingdom. He sends His Spirit. The kingdom is set up. By the way, that's one of those passages, you know, it wasn't. Jesus had to go away to get the kingdom. The kingdom wasn't on the earth during His ministry. He had to go away to get the kingdom. The Ancient of Days gave to one like unto the Son of Man a kingdom. And in Isaiah 7, it just again reiterates the assurance that we have from God that everything is done for a purpose. All of history has meaning. And God is managing everything, including you. But the whole story is for the benefit of those who are of a contrite spirit, who have the heart of God, the mind of God, or who can be brought to have that. That's the person that God is looking for. If one would enter the kingdom, he's got to repent of his sins. He's got to believe on the Son of Man, who was the Son of God. He's got to confess his faith. He's got to have his nature changed by the new birth. John 3, 3 and 5. Titus 3, 5 and 6. He can enter the kingdom. And one that sits on his throne, sees it all, and has managed the whole thing to that purpose, that a man might have forgiveness of his sins. If you're here this morning, not a Christian, come in faith, repent of your sins, make the good confession, be baptized into Christ for the remission of those sins. If you've done that and gone astray, it's a good time to come back. We encourage you to do it while together we stand, while we sing. Won't you come?